The River Nile, Egypt. Spanning more than 6,500 kilometres and crossing 11 countries, it is the longest river in Africa. In ancient times, the Egyptians called their country Kemet, meaning the Black Land, a reference to the rich black soil left by the annual flood of the mighty river. It was Herodotus, a Greek historian, who said, "If you drink from the Nile, you are always destined to return." Our story begins in the...
Wait, hang on a minute. Where's all the water gone?
Hi guys, in this episode we're looking at an argument over the Nile. As you just heard in that dramatic opening, Egypt is the country that most of us associate with the River Nile, but it's not the only one that it flows through. If you head upstream, you reach Sudan, where the Nile splits into two tributaries. The White Nile, which starts all the way up in Uganda, and the Blue Nile, which provides the vast majority of Nile water for those downstream countries. The Blue Nile begins in Ethiopia, and that's where we have a problem. A big dam problem. No, literally, it's a problem with a dam. I'm Hannah Gelbart, and this is What in the World from the BBC World Service. So the dam we're talking about is being built by Ethiopia's government, and its official name is the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, or GERD for short. And grand really is the right word here. It's absolutely massive, and it's going to be used to generate a huge amount of electricity for the country. But like all dams, the way it works is by limiting how much water gets through, and Egypt and Sudan are not happy about this. So we've got two BBC reporters, Kalkidan Yibeltal, who's in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa, and Jaide Tahe in Egypt's capital Cairo. Hi, Kalkidan. Hi, Jaide.
Hi,
hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. First of all, can you just explain how big this dam really is?
It is really big. At its completion, it's expected to be the largest hydroelectric dam in Africa. So that's really huge. And it's expected to generate around 6,000 megawatts of hydropower electricity. So that's really huge. In addition to the dam, there is also this huge lake that the reservoir is expected to create. And that lake is going to be the largest in Ethiopia as well. So this is a massive project.
And it's a hydroelectric dam, as you say. How much power are they hoping to be able to generate with it?
Well, upon completion, the aim is around 6,000 megawatts of electricity is expected to be generated from this dam. That's going to more than double Ethiopia's capacity to generate electricity. So this is huge. Tens of millions of people do not have access to electricity. And this is Africa's second most populous nation. Some estimates put the current population to be around 115 million. So that's a high number of people. And many of these people live in rural areas without access to electricity. So with that comes all these hardships to cook for sanitary purposes and so forth. So the hope is to electrify many of these households across the country and provide them the desperately needed electricity on a household level. As I said, there is also the other aspect of the dam, that is, Ethiopia wants it to help boost its economic growth and for the country to have this cheap electricity available so that foreign investors can be attracted to come here.
So Jaide, over to you. What is Egypt's problem with this dam?
From the Egyptian side, the main issue that Egyptian officials and analysts have warned against is basically access to water. And it repeatedly referred to the issue as an existential threat and a matter of national and water security. So for Egypt, the River Nile, which the Ethiopian dam is built on, constitutes more than 90% of its water resources. But it should be noted that according to officials, Cairo's problem is not really with the existence of the dam as much as it's about guaranteeing that its operation is done in a way that does not harm the downstream countries' shares of the water, especially during times of drought.
And the Nile has huge cultural significance in Egypt too.
Definitely. The ancient Egyptian civilization was heavily dependent on the Nile as it helped it develop agricultural methods very early on. Ancient Egyptians even named the god Hapi in reference to the Nile as an appreciation, especially during the times of flooding. The country was also often referred to as the gift of the Nile because of how it relied on the river for its survival. And you'd see this very clearly in songs that even until this very day are circulating about the Nile and how it's rooted in Egyptian identity and, you know, passes through Egyptian blood.
Do you think there's any chance of a compromise from Egypt, and what might that look like?
So we've been seeing ever since they started the process of the building of the dam, we've been seeing a lot of discussions between the two sides. And frankly, it has been going on for more than a decade now. And unfortunately, even though sometimes we see the reports in the media saying that there's about to be a breakthrough and a deal is about to be made, again, they come out and say that there's no really results, that did not yield any outcome. And that's just on the official level. But on the mainstream and social media level, the issue also constitutes a major concern for many Egyptians. And at the early stages of this tensions, chatter in the media went on to suggest the military route. And after each and every single phase of filling of the dam, you would see trending hashtags also expressing concerns, and some particularly lashing out at Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi for not stopping the dam's construction.
Kalkidan, what have people been saying about it from the Ethiopia side?
From the Ethiopia side, I would say that this project is one of the few, if not the only aspect in the country right now that just unifies the whole country. Ethiopia is a very divided country at this point. There was a very brutal civil war. But when it comes to this dam, there seems to be unified position, and it's a very popular project. Whenever there is a milestone regarding this dam, whenever a certain phase is completed, whenever there was a filling of the dam's reservoir, for example, there was a lot of celebration and there are popular songs and so forth. So it seems that here in Ethiopia, there is a unified support, it seems, to this project.
Do you think that there is any chance of an agreement or compromise between the two countries? What might it look like?
Well, there have been repeated efforts for a decade now in which the three countries, Egypt, Ethiopia, and as well as Sudan, have convened to try to find an agreement, but we still don't have that binding agreement. While they say several progresses have been made and understandings have been made, key issues, particularly about the water management in case of future possible droughts, for example, that have not been agreed on. Seeing that this dam is nearing its completion, it's at this point, it's hard to see any sort of, you know, dramatic shift in that regard. As things stand, it doesn't seem that there is much to agree on.
Kalkidan Jaide, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anna.
So the GERD is causing tensions before it's even finished. And for the time being, at least, it doesn't look as though upstream or downstream are in the mood to compromise. This isn't the first time countries have had disagreements over water. So for now, we're going to move away from Africa and head into Asia. We're going to swap the Nile for the Mekong River. We'll spare you the overly dramatic intro this time, but again, it's downstream versus upstream, and it's another big dam problem. Downstream, we have Myanmar, Laos, Thailand, and Cambodia. Upstream, there's China. Brian Eiler is from the foreign affairs think tank, the Stimson Centre, and has literally written a book on the subject. We asked him some questions and got him to break down the situation for us.
The mighty Mekong River is the lifeblood of mainland Southeast Asia. And of many superlatives, it is the world's largest fishery. It produces 20% of the world's freshwater fish. And its agricultural production is exported to the region of Southeast Asia and to the rest of the world. Tens of millions of people rely on the natural resources that are derived from the Mekong for their everyday livelihoods. China's got 11 large dams on the Mekong. In fact, two of them are the largest dams in the world. If you're from the United States, you might be familiar with the Chesapeake Bay. Those two largest dams hold about as much water as the Chesapeake Bay. Now, all that water is used for hydropower production, and it's sent to the east coast of China for manufacturing uses, to support manufacturing and industry. These dams, plus actually hundreds of other dams downstream, and China has over 100 dams on its tributaries of the Mekong as well, are all reducing the mighty Mekong flood pulse. And that flood pulse is kind of how the river shifts from the wet season to the dry season. It's really high during the wet season, and the river's really low during the dry season. So if you look at it on a graph, it's high to low. It looks like a heartbeat or a pulse, as you would see it on a display in a hospital. But what the dams are doing is they're restricting the peak of that pulse, and they're bringing up the low point. And that's kind of flatlining the river system. And when it's flatlining, that means there are fewer fisheries, there's less fish coming out of the river system, and agricultural production downstream suffers. China denies that its dams have any of these impacts. And in fact, China says that the flattening of the pulse is beneficial because it reduces floods during the wet season. And then also China says that its dry season releases of water from dams raises the level of the river to give more water to the downstream during the dry season. But the truth is the downstream doesn't need the water during the dry season. It's needed during the wet season. Much of the dry season releases don't spill out above the riverbanks to cause the productive flooding that makes the Mekong mighty and drives the fishery and the robust agricultural production.
So the similarities between what's happening on the Mekong and what's happening on the Nile are pretty clear. And as the effects of global warming become more apparent, with droughts and floods getting more extreme and water more scarce, we could see this situation start to play out in other places too. The technology has changed drastically, but most of human history can pretty much be boiled down to who controls the food and who controls the water. And things can get dramatic when that control is threatened. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you're as interested as we are in these huge infrastructure projects, then do check out our episode on China's Belt and Road Initiative, where we talk about railways that go nowhere and airports without any passengers. I'm Hannah Gelbart, and this is What in the World from the BBC World Service. We'll see you next time. Bye.